Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's May 1st, 2014 7th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 12-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 6. Marla Kreindler, Timothy Levin, and Bill Zimmerman will discuss certain issues surrounding getting alternatives into defined contribution plans. Now, on to the podcast.
We thought this would be an interesting topic because it really is one of those emerging things in the alternative space that I think, to my observation, has some very significant broad demographic and regulatory support behind it. And that is, one, there's a trend from DB, defined benefit, to DC, defined contribution plans across the country. And then second is that we're seeing an increasing interest in alternatives managers to go into more traditional asset management spaces and traditional asset managers to get into alternative management markets. The other thing is that now everybody's registered, so everybody can manage, as an investment advisor, can manage all sorts of products. These big forces or significant forces that I think are causing people to really take a hard look at the opportunity for alternatives in defined contribution plans. Marla, why don't you talk a little bit about what you see on this from the drivers here from the plan side?
Sure, and we're seeing the drivers coming both from the manager side, and so managers are coming to us and saying that our client base in the retirement, U.S. retirement plan area has traditionally been defined benefit plans. We're noticing the trend from defined benefit to defined contribution plans, so we want to be in that space, or we already have clients that are in the DB space and they're making changes to their DC plans, and we want to be a part of it. From the plan's perspective, they're really moving toward, you know, what we say in the industry is an institutional focus in defined contribution plans. And so they're thinking about ways to bring professional management into plans, whereas a few years ago we might have seen, you know, the majority of DC plans have registered funds and be invested more in traditional investments. What we're seeing, and in fact there's a paper that a group that we participate in called the Defined Contribution Institutional Investment Association that they just put out that really points to some of the differences in performance in DB versus DC plans, and noticing that some of that can potentially be attributed to the lack of alternatives in DC plans versus DB plans. And so the result then is that we're seeing within DC plans a focus on these institutional professional management structures. And at the same time, plan sponsors are seeing a lot of litigation in the DC plan area. There's been an increase in class action litigation. And so they then tend to focus on, from a fiduciary, how can I think about my plan from a risk management perspective? And the U.S. regulator, the Department of Labor that oversees these plans, has come up with regulations that say to a plan sponsor that if you default your participants' investments into one of four qualified default investment alternatives, then your fiduciary liability is pretty limited from a plan sponsor perspective. And so what does that mean then is that pretty much, you know, every plan sponsor that we work with has then chosen a default investment option for their plans, and predominantly that the main default investment option is what's known as a target date fund. And so what we're seeing then is a huge shift in defined contribution plans from being a type of program where participants can voluntarily elect to where what we're seeing happening for the most part within these plans is that participants are defaulted into an investment option, and that investment option is the target date fund.
And just for anybody who doesn't know the basics of a target date fund structure, the idea is that you have a single retirement plan option that is a diversified investment program where the allocation is geared toward the employee's ultimate date of retirement. So if you project that you are going to retire in, you know, 2025, then there would be a target date 2025 fund available to you.
Sure, and it includes a glide path so that the assets automatically rebalance. So if you were to invest or be defaulted into a target date fund at a young age, you would expect the target date fund glide path would move the asset allocation to a more conservative investment strategy over time. And the initial target date funds really were proprietary funds where maybe a single investment management house managed all the assets, and we still see a lot of that. But as plan fiduciaries are thinking about institutional structures and professional management, what we're seeing now is, I don't know if we'd say it's a prevalence, but it's definitely a growing trend toward custom target date funds. And a custom target date fund is where the plan sponsor steps back and says, wait a minute, if I really believe in bringing in best-in-class managers, then maybe if I'm giving participants a complete asset allocation, I want that asset allocation to reflect the best-in-class managers that I've selected for my plans generally. And so that then means that they'll bring in managers that they're using on the DC plan side. But increasingly what we're seeing is them saying that best-in-class managers, let me borrow some of the talent and strategies that I'm using in the defined benefit side, and again, to try to get the better performance in these professionally managed funds to bring in alternatives and other types of asset classes.
Right. And we were just discussing this as we were preparing for this panel. I think we had some debate about exactly what the different projections are for target date fund assets to grow to in the next 5, 10, 15 years. And we were throwing out different numbers, but all of them are in the multiple trillions of dollars over the next 10 years to be invested in target date funds. And so if you are a manager who is in the alternatives area, even if alternatives end up being only a relatively small allocation in that investment universe, 5% of a $10 trillion market is a pretty big market itself.
Right, and the numbers we're seeing currently are 20% of DC plans, and for large plans that do what we call re-enrollment, and in that case, they tend to default participants, all participants, into the target date funds. I'm seeing numbers now of like between 80 and 90% of multi-billion or multi-billion dollar plans going into target date funds. And so you think about it and you say, well, how do we put alternatives into defined contribution plans? We know that defined contribution plans are subject to participant-directed investments. Participants are retail. How are they going to act? How can I manage that within an alternative structure? And remember that these investments are largely defaulted. Part of the reason, too, that plan sponsors move DC plans into default investments is because there's this whole thing called inertia. Participants are viewed as, I mean, I don't know how many people here change your investment options in your DC plan all the time, but this is the investment community, and let's say across the broader universe, there's just not a lot of changes being made by participants annually, if at all. And it's also the case that the target date fund is built with multiple asset classes within the structure. And so within the target date fund, you expect like a liquidity tier or cash buffer within the front, and then allocations to maybe more liquid investments. So when a plan sponsor is including alternatives, the alternatives are buffered by the rest of the fund's assets and the expectation, you know, absent some unusual circumstances, that you'll have a more predictable rebalancing and know, you know, when monies are coming in and out of the fund.
So the target date funds we're finding are, in a way, apart from being a large potential market, the target date funds have some characteristics that are peculiar to target date funds that make them potentially more suitable for introduction of alternative strategies. And Marla mentioned them. They are pricing, where you're going to have to deal with a daily price, but at least here you're dealing with a daily price to the target date fund that gets composed in the target date fund's own NAV. You're talking about liquidity issues where there's oftentimes a mismatch between liquidity and the typical alternative investment structure. The target date fund, as Marla said, can better manage that than a direct investment option could. And then also that's more consistent with the target dates and the defaulting, where you would largely expect a more predictable cash flow, in fact, probably a positive cash flow, and less concern about how the need to meet redemptions on a daily basis as a practical matter are going to affect your investment program. But that doesn't mean that all of this has been easy, and there is a single obvious investment product that's sitting out there waiting to be plugged into the target date market. What we found is that people are looking at many different alternatives. Registered funds is one. The advantage to a registered fund is that if you can figure out how to do this well in a registered fund product, your product is potentially available to other more retail type of investment programs as well. But registered funds have particular issues with restrictions on amounts that can be invested in illiquid securities, restrictions on pyramiding different types of investment vehicles, and then oftentimes what turns out to be a very sticky issue is prohibitions under the Investment Company Act on transactions with affiliates. And so people also are looking at other different types of products. And Marla, why don't you talk a little bit about the CITs and group trusts?
Sure. And so one of the more common institutional products and defined contribution plans today, other than registered funds, are what we call collective investment trusts or group trusts. And a collective investment trust is a commingled investment vehicle where you have a bank or trust company serve as trustee, and then the bank or trust company maintains the trust structure, so it becomes whoever that trustee is, it's their trust. But on the other hand, through a series of regulatory guidance that we've worked our way through over the years, that these trust companies can bring in sub-advisors who need not be affiliated with the trust companies, provided there's some kind of oversight from that bank trustee. And so what we've seen in defined contribution plans is really a proliferation of collective investment trusts as one of the primary investment vehicles. What's interesting about collective trusts is that this type of structure then is exempt from registration as an investment company. And so what people have found in putting together custom structures is that there's flexibility in a lot of ways in terms of the investment strategies, et cetera, in terms of your ways to be able to customize the structure. Also, what we found is that when you're managing these assets, it's automatically subject to ERISA, and so the defined contribution plan fiduciaries are comfortable with that structure, and it's one that they've used for a number of years. From a challenge perspective, maybe working with a trustee is something that might be unusual for some of you, but we found that our clients find the right partner and get comfortable with that. And there are some restrictions, maybe a little different from registered funds, but there are some restrictions on illiquid investments because the idea is that these assets are supposed to be readily liquid, and so we don't quite see gating provisions like you might see in traditional funds.
Yeah. Now, Bill, we also have onshore or offshore private funds listed here, but that's, I think, less of a securities law issue than something that...
Yeah, and we'll talk about it a little bit later about the blocking effect of UBIT, but oftentimes you'll use an offshore fund to block the UBIT using taxed as a corporation.
Yeah, so depending upon which of these vehicles you're going to go with, you may or may not have to deal with the same UBIT issues that you're accustomed to dealing with on the private fund side of this. And then also, the last one here is the separately managed account or the fund of one. I don't know, Marla, if you have any comments on how prevalent that really is.
Yeah, you know, maybe less so, but what we're finding is that alternatives managers that already have existing relationships with large institutional clients will find the separately managed account structure as being just a simple way to offer a DC solution to that client, and because the client is already familiar with the manager, it's something that can be done relatively easily for those large institutional managers. And maybe, Tim, if you want to just touch on, for private funds, people often think of that they're not really DC ready because of, you know, rules that we talk about sometimes as Standish, but the advantage of the custom target date fund and how it's set up is that they're basically, custom target dates allow you to navigate through the Standish rules pretty easily.
That's right. The advantage is that if you can build something that satisfies the valuation and the liquidity demands of the retirement marketplace, when you have a target date fund that is the investor, the target date fund would be viewed as the investor for purposes of determining your compliance with Section 3C7. So as long as your target date fund is a qualified purchaser, then it would be generally able to invest directly into your underlying fund that relies on 3C7 just as your current private funds do. And the line of no action letters that deal with this, probably this determination of who's the qualified purchaser, whether it's the fund or the plan itself, as opposed to the individual participants in the plan, is the Standish no action letter.
Right.
What, Marla, do you think are the client-facing considerations here, coming from your perspective advising fiduciaries?
Yeah, so one of the things that, you know, the defined contribution plan fiduciary will just look for is simplicity in the structure. And so is what you're providing something similar to what they're already used to seeing? How is it different? Does that difference require them to take steps or to think about things differently than they'd otherwise have to? And that may be one of the key reasons people that are really trying to market to this asset class are maybe thinking about registered funds or collective trusts, because they're things that are already familiar to these clients. The fiduciary considerations, you know, they'll be looking there again at, you know, the structure, but also that makes CITs comfortable as they understand that those managing those assets already are automatically ERISA fiduciaries. And fees are something to think about in the DC space. While these assets, say if an alternative within a target date fund is maybe going to comprise 5% or some smaller percent, then you can imagine that the impact of alternatives fees on an otherwise traditional asset management structure may be on the margin not all that significant. But then the questions come up in terms of how do you disclose the fee structures within target date funds to participants? And the Department of Labor has come up with a lot of rules around that lately. There's a lot of focus on it. And so that's something we've sought to work through carefully with clients together with Tim's group, particularly because the Department of Labor's rules just borrow from the SEC registered fund rules. So it's something to be mindful of there. And then last, that you have to put together a structure that's really going to plug into the DC plan record keeping system and coordinating with record keepers. So it's maybe different parties than what you're used to otherwise.
Bill, why don't you talk a little bit about the tax considerations here?
Marla had indicated that in the alternative areas that we're talking about, I wanted to delve into the private funds. But she said, no, just talk about the regulated investment companies, which are the registered funds which are offered here. The most important rules here are regulated investment companies are great options for alternative investments, except there's a rule called the qualifying income rule, and that rule limits the type of income which can arise out of the portfolio and still have that entity be taxable as a regulated investment company or mutual fund. And so we've found that that is really one of the limits that a lot of clients have when they look to these kind of products. The only things that you can have in the qualifying income area are dividends, interest, and income from the sale of stocks and securities. And that has proven to be a stumbling block. In addition, we talk about considerations for 81-100 trusts. Marla and I always try to at least have a conversation up front. Are we talking about a collective investment fund, a collective investment trust? Everybody has a different definition. In the tax world, we do. In Marla's world, she has a different definition. So one of the things to get straight up front is exactly what entity we're talking about. The neat thing about 81-100 trusts is that they get to pay the UBIT and avoid having passed through the UBIT up to their investors. They report it and pay it. It's an easy way to deal with an exposure to alternatives and deal with the filing and tax requirements.
Well, I think that what we're finding here is that there is no single perfect structure, and that it's still very early in the development of these types of products. It's really sort of like the first or second inning in terms of people figuring out how to get the product built and then where the product is going to be sold and what the real opportunity is. But there's still a lot of time for people to work out new structures. It's just a process that requires triangulating among various different regulatory schemes.
To listen to other panels from the 2014 7th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit Podcast Central at morganlewis.com. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefundsresources.